This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, Samoa's government shuts down the public service as it continues to grapple with the growing measles emergency. Also coming up, Papua New Guineans warned they face a tough year ahead after the 2020 budget revealed that things like free education will be off the table. But what difference will it make?
For myself, I've been paying, so I don't see there's a free education.
They're already struggling. They're finding it hard to feed their children a lot of times. Now they're going to have to find school fees or take the kids out of school again.
And also, questions from the public have been put to some of the Pacific's most senior leaders as ABC TV's Q&A program came to the Pacific. Those leaders yet again sent a strong message to Australia on climate change, but they didn't always see eye to eye on other issues ranging from China to domestic violence.
Now, what does that mean to end climate change? So what
here?
You can do...
I mean, what you're referring to, AGI, that's correct. I mean, you've done a lot of legal reform in this country, which is great. There is this psyche that exists in our country, particularly in Fiji, and I'm sorry, but it's a psyche that is perpetuated by, I have to say, your government.
More on that story and more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. First this morning, Samoa's government has taken the extraordinary measure of shutting down its public service later this week as it continues to try to get on top of the country's worsening measles emergency. There have now been 53 measles-related deaths, all but five of them were children aged four and under. In a state address yesterday, the Prime Minister, Tuilepa Soilihi, announced that all public services except for power and water utilities will close on Thursday, so the public servants can help with the mass vaccination campaign that is underway. Health authorities say, though, that despite that vaccination drive and the fact that vaccinations are actually mandatory under the State of Emergency Declaration, more than 50% of children under 4 years still haven't been vaccinated. The Prime Minister had a clear message on that to try and counter those anti-vaccination attitudes.
We need to understand the following issues. First, vaccinations is the only cure. Two, if affected cases are presented early for treatment, full recovery should be expected. And thirdly, no traditional healers or Kanchen water preparations can cure measles.
Prime Minister Tuilepa's reminder there came after health officials and police actually shut down an operation in the capital Apia that has been treating people with what the owner claims is healing water, as Liam Fox reports.
Fritz Alayasa has claimed he just wants to help sick people.
I would like to help the government to offer eye time. Because Christmas and New Year is coming at the moment. There's a lot of people, you know, visit their families. I want some disease or germs to be cured.
Pacific Beat visited his home late last month where he treats people at his so-called clinic, an open-air farlay next to his house. Around 200 men, women and children had turned up to be treated with what he calls his Kangen water. This was despite an official ban on children attending large public gatherings as part of the emergency response to the measles epidemic. Some of them were clearly suffering from measles, with the telltale red rash over their faces and bodies. Mr. Alayasa's treatment involves getting his customers to drink his water, then he and his assistants spray it on them. Mr. Alayasa has previously claimed the water can cure measles, but he was more circumspect when Pacific Beat spoke to him.
They're feeling good. The measles already not cure, but it's already back to normal.
So it helps to treat, alleviate the symptoms, make people feel better?
Yes, sir.
And how does your water treat the disease?
It's a water straight from the machine. It's fresh.
And that's enough to treat people?
Yes.
It's just tap water that's been run through a small filter in Mr. Alayasa's kitchen to make it more alkaline. But some of the parents there were adamant it had helped their sick children. One of them was Janet Vaitugutu, who had brought her four-year-old son, Jordan.
I thank God for the Kangen water. It's really helpful for him to get back.
He's already had it before?
Yeah. No, the water.
He's had the water already? And you think it made a difference?
Very big difference.
But authorities have had enough, and health officials shut down his so-called clinic last week. The Samoa Observer reported it was open again last Saturday, with more parents lining up to pay for their children to be sprayed with his water. Mr. Aliasa told the newspaper the Prime Minister, Tuilaepa Sailele, had personally approved the reopening of his clinic. That claim was rejected by the PM's office. Later on Saturday, police accompanied health officials as they shut down the clinic for a second time. Police did not arrest Mr. Aliasa, but warned that's an option if he continues to defy the shutdown. Pacific Beat has sought comment from the police commissioner. The Director General of Health, Liausa Take Naseri, has previously tried to warn people against using alternative and traditional therapies to treat measles, saying any delay in seeking proper medical treatment can cost lives. But it's a sign of how desperate some people have become as the epidemic continues to worsen that they're willing to try anything to help their children.
It is Liam Fox reporting there. Well, Papua New Guineans are being warned that they face a tough year ahead after the PNG government handed down its budget for 2020 last week. Now, among the major changes, free education is out. Parents will now need to pay half of their children's school fees. Meanwhile, the country's opposition says that the government's decision to accept a loan worth $440 million from Australia is a backward step, as Evan Wasuka reports.
There's been plenty of attention on Papua New Guinea's 2020 budget, especially with the inclusion of a $440 million Australian dollar loan from Canberra. Paul Barker is the Executive Director of the Institute of National Affairs.
We understand from the Secretary for Treasury that it's around the 2.5% interest rate, but in terms of the duration, when it has to be repaid, I've not seen the details. I'm not sure that they've been revealed at this stage.
Shadow Treasurer Joseph Lelang says the loan was a bad move and an irresponsible one.
Putting it to support the budget and pay recurrent activities, I think that's a waste. That loan should have never come in the first place. Of course, the PNG government is jumping up and down, saying that that's a very, very good loan, but it's not. The reason it's not is because it's going to be repaid back within 12 months.
Mr. Lelang says the use of loans for budget support is risky and harks back to poor practices of the 1980s.
And I'm very surprised that the Australian government has backtracked and is giving direct budget support.
Mr. Barker from the Institute of National Affairs says according to budget documents, Australia's loan will not be the last that PNG will be getting.
So the budget does actually have a very large increase in expected financing or borrowing. Instead of being what it has been for the last few years of 2 to 2.5 billion, it was 2.5 billion for this year that was forecast. For next year, they're actually envisaging 4.5 billion, which is obviously a very, very substantial increase in borrowing.
One area that's been generating plenty of discussion is education, with the government announcing that it's scaling back its fee-free education system, which means that from next year, parents will have to start paying half of all secondary school fees. Barbara Pagasa lives in Mount Hagen. She's got three children in secondary school.
For myself, I've been paying, so I don't see there's a free education. That's on my side because I've been paying, like you said, project fee or any other fees like that, we've been paying.
Lydia Kailap is an Australian married to a Papua New Guinean. She lives in Kimbe, and she says families there will definitely feel the pinch with the removal of the fee-free education.
The average family, really, they're already struggling. They're finding it hard to even feed their children a lot of times. Now they're going to have to find school fees or take the kids out of school again once they grow up, and all of a sudden they're adults, young adults. They've got no education, they can't get a job.
Shadow Treasurer Joseph Lelang says parents are going to be hard hit and it's creating uncertainty about education for next year.
This policy should have been phased over 2 or 3 years.
By cutting back on fees, the government says the funding will instead go into a new loan scheme for tertiary students. But Mr. Lelang is unconvinced, saying more details are needed.
I think a lot of parents out there are very, very confused. They really want to know more, and I think it is only fair that the government must come out and start explaining how it will go about dealing with that.
Joseph Leilung, he's the Shadow Treasurer in Papua New Guinea. Evan Wasuka reporting.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, the International Climate Summit that's called COP25 has now begun in Madrid in Spain, kicking off 2 weeks of talks between world leaders and climate experts and activists, including many from the Pacific. This year has been called the point of no return. It could make or break global climate targets. And that is because this is the last meeting before 2020, the year that delegates have agreed that global greenhouse gases will be reaching their peak levels. Now, to make sure that that all happens, most countries will need to make ambitious commitments to lower their carbon emissions. The Cook Islands Prime Minister, Henry Puna, is amongst those in Madrid. Here he is outlining the urgent need for action.
We've achieved all our Millennium Development Goals. Yet, no matter these achievements, we cannot escape our vulnerability to climate change. A single event will cancel out all our development gains in one stroke.
What is the purpose of COP25? How can the meeting help tackle climate change globally? Reporter Yvonne Yong has taken a look.
It's designed to take the next crucial steps in the UN climate change process. Last year at COP24 in Poland, there was agreement on the implementation rules of the 2015 Paris Agreement, which aims to limit a rise in global temperatures to between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius. Well, now countries need to discuss how to make it fully operational. And they've got until COP26 in Glasgow next year to negotiate and finalise the terms. For example, how exactly will international carbon trading, known as Article 6, work? Almost every country in the world has signed on to putting new climate pledges on the table before the end of 2020. These talks kick off discussions on how they'll do this. What's expected of the countries? UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres is urging countries to significantly increase their carbon-cutting ambitions, particularly those who emit the most, with the goal of reaching carbon neutrality by 2050. He says subsidies for fossil fuel extraction must end and no new coal-fired power stations must be built after 2020.
The World Meteorological Organization is releasing its State of the Climate report at this conference. And its findings are clear. The last 5 years have been the hottest ever recorded. Sea levels are the highest in human history. Ice caps are melting at unprecedented speed, and the oceans are becoming more acidic, with all its consequences.
Mr. Guterres says we simply have to stop digging and drilling and take advantage of the vast possibilities offered by renewable energy and nature-based solutions. So what are the challenges? It all won't be straightforward. Lack of consensus and scepticism from key player the US don't make it easy. Washington played an important leadership role in the talks until Donald Trump announced the US would withdraw from the Paris Agreement. It'll be out by this time next year. Small economies such as New Zealand, which recently passed a law to reach net zero emissions by 2050, are taking the lead. The EU and China are expected to outline more ambitious carbon plans, but they've got a few hurdles to overcome, such as agreeing on a possible carbon border tax.
Yvonne Yong explaining COP25. Well, a strong message was delivered to Australia on how it handles the issue of climate change by Pacific leaders who otherwise didn't necessarily see eye to eye on other topics ranging from domestic violence to the growing interest of China in the Pacific region. It was part of the first ever episode of ABC TV's long-running program Q&A to be filmed in the Pacific. Now, that show gives members of the public the chance to ask senior leaders questions on live television. The panel in the Pacific included the former Tuvalu Prime Minister, Anele Sopawanga, Fiji's Attorney General, Ayaz Sayed Kayum, the head of the region's fishing agency, as well as Australia's Pacific Minister, Alex Hawke, and the Pacific feminist, Viracilia Buadromo. Now, climate change dominated the discussions, and Anele Sopawanga again took aim at Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, accusing him of underplaying the threat that climate change poses to low-lying Pacific Island nations. Reporter Lithe Mavono was in the audience in Fiji's capital yesterday. I spoke to her a short time ago.
There were a number of questions on climate change alone. and a very strong discussion on it, especially with regards to issues on relocation, on climate-friendly visas, on whether there's enough money being poured into the Pacific from its biggest neighbours for adaptation and resilience work. Virisile Mbondrama, Pacific human rights activist, spoke very strongly on the need to realise that not everyone in the Pacific, despite the pressures they're facing due to climate change, actually wants to relocate to its bigger neighbours. And so it led to another discussion about whether or not Australia is actually taking a strong enough stand against coal mining. And that was something that seemed to unite the rest of the panellists against Australia.
So it was a very clear message delivered unanimously by the Pacific leaders on the panel, but Australia's representative there, Alex Hawke, said the same message we have heard before, is Australia already is doing a lot, and particularly on that angle of helping Pacific countries adapt to climate change. But we heard from the former Prime Minister of Tuvalu in reaction to that.
Anela Sopoanga reminded the Australian parliamentarian, as well as the other leaders in the region, that they needed to take a stronger stand with regards to ensuring that wild relocation was not an issue, and he didn't want the people of Tuvalu referred to as climate refugees, that there needed to be stronger intervention from the United Nations on the loss and damages aspect of what it means when Pacific Islanders do lose their islands.
Relocation issue and compensation has to be considered. And in order for that to work, no single country can do it on its own. We have to have a United Nations Convention on the rights to protect the rights of people displaced and relocated by impacts of climate change. That we need to take it to the United Nations as soon as possible.
Lithe, beyond climate change, another big issue in the Pacific is that of gender violence, domestic violence against women, and it caused some heated debate.
It did, Catherine. Virisile Mbondrama is quite a leading figure in the human rights and particularly in the gender violence space in the Pacific and more so in Fiji. And there was a lot of conversation, especially from the Fijian government representative, Ayaz Kayum, about how much work, particularly in law reform, had been done to address the gender violence situation. But Virisile quite passionately pointed out that this work was all post injury, post-deaths, and wanted stronger and clearer messages from the Fijian government about how to actually prevent the deaths of women and children due to gender violence. And it led to a little bit of a domestic conversation around whether or not the Fijian government was actually walking the talk when it came to not perpetuating masculinity and other factors that Virisile said causes gender violence in the region.
And we can take a listen to that now.
There's various opportunities to get domestic violence restraining orders. You can get it any time of the day. Now, what does that mean to any time of the night? So what you can do...
I mean, what you're referring to there, Gia, that's correct. I mean, you've done a lot of legal reform in this country, which is great. Thank you very much. There is this psyche that exists in our country, particularly in Fiji. And I'm sorry, but it's a psyche that is perpetuated by... I have to say, your government, your prime minister, has perpetuated this sort of psyche where violence is okay.
Another big issue in the region, of course, now is China. That caused, again, differing views on that.
Yes, there was a lot of conversation about China's role in the region and whether or not the Pacific Island nations were able to leverage the position that they find themselves in now as the ground where China and the other superpowers of the world are fighting for dominance. Ayaz Said Kayum said that on the part of Fiji that he wasn't worried, that actually the Fijian government hadn't borrowed from China since 2012. But he did get a lot of opposition from Anela Sopoanga, who was quite passionate in calling for a reconsideration of Fiji's stance in terms of supporting China in the Pacific. And he may have even taken a little bit of a stab at some other Pacific Island nations and the close relationship that they have with China.
At the end of the day, I think the leverage argument, I think, is there. Yes, Australia. I mean, Australia for all these decades, in fact, has never made finance facility available to the Pacific for infrastructure development. Now, maybe now that they're offering that is because of the Chinese actually offering infrastructure funds available for us. I assume that that's what it is. Good for us. because now we can actually, we have a smorgasbord of financiers to actually choose from. The idea is to, if you embark on projects that are going to fail, I mean, if you're going to go and borrow money from the Chinese to plonk a very large convention centre on top of a hill for $300 million, it's not going to get used only once a year, then obviously it's a silly investment.
Overall, was this a useful exercise? What did the audience make of this Australian television program where viewers or people in the audience are allowed to ask questions of very senior people?
Catherine, the atmosphere at last night's University of the South Pacific Theatre was very festive. It was akin to a party almost. People here have not had the opportunity to hold their leaders accountable on a public platform and even ask of them or be seen to criticise them on television the way that it rolled out last night. It's been quite a long time, maybe even a decade, since Fijian leaders and those in positions of power could be asked the kind of questions that were asked on Q&A last night.
It's reporter Leve Mavono in the Fiji capital, Suva, and part of the audience for that program Q&A last night. Well, the drive to take sport to higher levels in Vanuatu has taken another big leap forward, with one of Australia's greatest rugby league stars, Cameron Smith, stepping into the role of sporting ambassador, as Richard Hewitt reports.
Six more tackles. Smith! Cameron Smith will score! Cameron Smith, the greatest player of all time.
But I always say, if I want to win a football game, the first guy I would pick is Cameron Smith, because he just knows how to win.
I think Cameron Smith is the ultimate professional, articulate, intelligent, and clearly a really good leader of men. And I've watched him on many occasions when he has the chat with his teammates in the sheds and even out on the paddock. Even though he's given that speech so many times, you can see that nobody loses eye contact with him. It's clear that whatever he's saying is worth listening to, and everybody is very focused on what he does have to say.
Tributes for Cameron Smith from two fellow rugby league greats, Darren Lockyer and then Peter Stirling, on the occasion of his 400th match for Melbourne Storm, and spelling out why one of the key figures in Vanuatu sport, Cricket Association President Mark Stafford, is thrilled to have the superstar on board.
We've got lots of people on the ground here who are going to be supportive, who are really pleased that he's been able to walk amongst us in the biblical sort of sense last week, that he's embraced the friendliness of the people and the desire to get involved and progress through regional sports and local sport.
Smith has no previous connections with Vanuatu, so how was he persuaded to take on the role of sporting ambassador?
We're friends with the people at Melbourne Storm, and through discussions with them and an idea, we've been able to push through and bring it to fruition. And the government ministers involved have been wonderful. The foreign minister has been part of it, the minister for youth and sport, the minister for tourism and trade.
It's an open-ended appointment, and one that may take on greater significance when Cameron Smith eventually retires from playing. And just as his teammates do now, the hope is people in the wider sporting world will listen when he talks up Vanuatu.
I will ensure that he gets enough information about what's happening and where there is some particular events, particularly with Vanuatu Rugby League, but in other sports like my own cricket background and beach volleyball is getting bigger on the world stage. We've got a couple of young rowers that are certainly Commonwealth class, and through athletics and soccer and so on. If there's something that's happening and Cameron references it, it's all for the benefit of bringing awareness throughout the region of what is going on in Vanuatu sport.
And what better way to add to the momentum in Vanuatu sport that's seen the launch of a national sports plan and a big push to host the 2027 Pacific Games under the ministry of Francois Chenie.
We need the government to start to realise that what are we going to do with these youth? These youth are naturally blessed with talent. We have to start to give them an outing, you know, somewhere where they can go and start to practice their talent to feed up to the elite program. And that's why that momentum that we're talking about, we must not let go. So we have to keep that fire burning.
And naturally, you would expect that Cameron Smith can do much to raise the profile of rugby league in Vanuatu and maybe ensure that when the next Pacific Games come around, both men's and women's teams will actually make the trip. That wasn't the case at the Samoa Games back in July because of a shortage of funds.
We'd certainly hope that Cameron would be able to instill enough interest to ensure fundraising, however it needs to be arranged, will have a focus on getting rugby league into further development.
Oh, Cameron Smith, he slipped over and they still got it!
It is Mark Stafford, Vanuatu's Cricket Association President Richard Hewitt reporting there. That's all for Pacific Beat today. Stay tuned because there's more Pacific Mornings with Talia Olatea up next on ABC Radio Australia.